Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of Security Nation, the podcast where we talk to inspiring individuals doing amazing things. You see, I do know different adjectives.
Hey,
I can
look at
use
that.
Them sometimes.
Mixed
it's
it up.
Incredible. I'm your host, Jen Ellis. I'm the VP of Community and Public Affairs at Rapid7, and it's been a long day. I'm quite tired. also with me is my co-host, Todd Bidsley, who probably has more energy than I do. Hey, Todd, how you doing?
I don't know about that, but okay. we'll take it.
How is Austin? Is it delightfully balmy?
Oh, God. Jen. our poor state. Texas is not doing great as we're recording this, so stay tuned for that, I guess.
All right, so moving swiftly on.
Yes. It's so sad.
I do have an amazing ability to bring us down. So Todd, like, we have a really cool guest this week.
God damn it,
I did so well. I didn't call him cool in the intro, and there it is. But he's
gotta put a nickel in the cool jar.
He's kind of a legit security community royalty. We've had some good guests on this show so far. I like it. I feel like I just get to talk to like really amazing people all the time, which is really nice.
Well, I have a surprise for you, Jen, because he's standing right behind you. Hey, Dave.
I'm right behind you right now.
Oh.
All the way out to London to say hi, you know?
So, I mean, I kind of want to be like, Dave Kennedy requires no intro, but at the same time, that feels like a bit of a bullshit thing to do. So we probably should actually introduce you. So you are the founder and CEO of TrustedSec, and you also have done 1,000,010 other things. It's a very specific number, 1,000,010. Would you like to tell us about maybe the 10, not the million? Just one or two other things. Like, you have at least one other company. You have an open source project, if not 15 open source projects. You ran a conference. Like, is there anything you don't do?
Geez, I don't know. I don't do well at like car mechanics.
Okay, good
I've
to know.
I've learned just to turn that in. Yeah, that's a you don't want me working on your car at all.
That's good to know. Like, don't go looking for you at the car hacking village, I guess.
No. I would probably somehow unintentionally blow the car up in an accident.
Oh my God, do go looking for you at the car hacking village. This sounds amazing.
I really want to be a car guy. I've really tried. I just can't do it. I don't have that part of my brain that's like, hey, I'm going to fix this car up. I just can't do it. Computer is no problem, but cars, don't have me do it.
Yeah, I did auto shop in high school, but computers were not really in cars then, and especially in the old cars that we had. So mechanically easy, but today impossible.
Did you enjoy doing auto shop? I can totally see this being a thing.
I did. Yeah, I could time a distributor cap. That's about as far as I got. So pretty fun.
I totally see this. I wish I had seen it in real life. Weirdly though, like I'm sort of like putting you in Greece, which I think is like weird.
Uh-huh.
So now, yep. Like,
there was a lot of singing.
The sleeves of your t-shirts are rolled up and you've got like a soft pack of cigarettes in there. And like, that's how it looks to
Absolutely
me.
Absolutely true.
You're like pulling out your comb and like, you know, combing back the sides of your hair.
Alas, I don't own a comb today.
This, for anyone who knows you, is highly believable. So Dave, thank you for joining us. It's lovely to see you, or not see you.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on. It's always good to hear from you folks. And Jen, you know, I know we go back years and years and years together, and you know, thanks so much for having me on here. Very humble to be on.
I had missed the fact we haven't had the opportunity to do something fun together for a long, long time, but you are a busy, busy man. Like, it's insane how busy you are.
It is. You know, it's, you know, when I first started running my own company at TrustedSec, and I started a second company, Binary Defense, you know, I'm kind of a glutton for punishment, I think. You know, and on top of that, I was running a conference, and on top of that, I had open source projects, and I, you know, running all these companies and doing the media and all that other stuff. It's a lot, but, you know, I really try to balance my family time. That's number one, most important for me. And what's, you know, obviously this whole area has been, you know, this whole situation has been really unfortunate, but, you know, a very positive thing out of it is that I've spent more time with my family and my kids than I ever have in our entire marriage. I've always been on the road traveling. And so that's been really great.
Yeah. So like one of the things that I think is quite interesting about COVID is that there are, you know, there's a legion of people in the security community and presumably in other communities as well, who are actually just kind of like, I don't have to travel, flights for me. and I'm kind of one of them, even though it does mean that I am living in my brother's attic. Yeah. So he may not be doing the happy dance, but I'm pretty good with the fact that I haven't had to get on a plane recently. It's been delightful, let me tell you.
I really think that I will probably not travel nearly as much, maybe only a couple handful times a year now, based off of this. And you know, I really do enjoy working from home. I got a routine, I work out, you know, I'm eating healthy, like all these things that I've always wanted to do. But, you know, when you're traveling, you're like, well, hey, we're going to go to this awesome restaurant that, you know, is like, has amazing steaks, you know, and so things have really changed quite a bit for me in my lifestyle. And I really, really enjoy being home.
Yeah. I mean, every meal becomes much more of a thing for sure. And like, I end up doing meetings where every meal is a meeting, which is like, that's not a good lifestyle. Because you do like, I'm going to have a big breakfast and a big lunch and a big dinner. It's not, that's not a good way of doing things. And I did see the other day that, you know, your home office is pretty lush. So,
Yeah,
I can totally see the appeal.
I have screens everywhere. I got a standing desk, you know, it definitely works for me. I stand all day long. I enjoy that. And, you know, the only things I get is when the dogs are barking, they have an amazing knack that as soon as I get on a podcast or I'm going on the news, they instantly go into terror mode where they're just screaming and howling and tearing apart each other. So that's always fun, obviously, to navigate, but it's
big. It's something for us to look forward to then. That's
you know. Right.
It's the same thing except children.
Yeah, children are really well behaved. They know not to bother dad, you know, when he's in his room and he's got the door shut. But you know, my dogs on the other hand do not recognize that yet.
I mean, that's just a question of training, Dave. Like, you just need to get on it. Like, what have you been doing?
I'll zap them if they come in the door. Just kidding.
No. Yes, no, please don't write in. We promise you that Mr. Kennedy is not abusing his dogs.
Totally a joke, just a joke.
So what else have you been up to? Because I know that you are a man who keeps busy. That's kind of the theme of your life. So what have you been doing?
You know, for me, you know, what's been nice about this work from home is that it's allowed me to get on more engagements. You know, one thing I don't want to do is lose my technical abilities and my skills. So I always try to hop on engagements throughout the year that are exciting, that are fun, where I can learn from my other teammates. And you know,
and when you say engagements, I'm sorry, like I tend to interrupt people to just get clarity for people who don't know. What kind of engagements are you talking about?
Like red team engagements, you know, we're going after customers and, you know, trying to simulate more of an adversary going after the organization and, you know, more of the harder, you know, challenging engagements where, you know, you might have to come up with something new or unique that hasn't been done before, you know, really try to flex that brain. You know, I find when I'm on a red team, you know, like what happens, my routine at night, by the way, is every other night I go downstairs and I go and I play video games when the kids are all in bed for a couple hours. But when I'm on a red team, I'm like frantically coding until like 2 a.m. And I feel like I've accomplished, you know, amazing things as I'm going through and doing all this. And I feel like my brain has been worked out versus, you know, kind of shutting off your brain when you're going on these games. So for me, you know, red teaming is really about, you know, using the skills that you've historically built up over your career and really being able to apply them for a really challenging situation. And so for me, getting on engagements is just so much fun. I really enjoy it. And it kind of gets you out of the day-to-day running companies type of role and staying technical with what you're doing.
I'm really interested in the fact that you're coding on red team engagements, because like a lot of people tell me that really like a lot of the sort of standard nonsense works. And so they don't really have to do the creative stuff. So like the fact that in and of itself, you're spending time, as you say, exercising your brain, coming up with these creative things to do, like how much does that really come up on engagements?
It depends on the organization you're going after, right? And every organization's unique in their maturity level and security. And so when you're going after a company and, you know, they're still at a very immature state in security, yeah, absolutely. You know, the same type of tools and approach that you would use for any organization works. You know, but when you're stuck in a situation, what really got me into security, you know, early on, and I used to be in the old IRC days with Remote Exploit, which eventually became Offensive Security. And I was on the Backtrack development team and Exploit DB development team and, you know, all those different ones there. And so for me, you know, the big enticing thing for me was a lot of things hadn't been done yet. And still to this day, a lot of things still have not been done yet. And when you run into a situation where your back's against the wall and you're frustrated and you can't figure things out, and there's not a tool out there to help you, there's not an exploit out there to help you, you have to figure out a different way. You have to be creative as an attacker. And that mindset has really helped me throughout my entire career to excel myself both in my knowledge and in the positions that I'm in and in what I do. I I literally can't stop. And this is probably a problem, actually, I'm sure, too. I literally can't stop thinking about something where I'm stuck in that corner. Like, my brain just keeps going and going and going and going. I remember, gosh, this is probably 6 or 7 years ago. I was working on a new version of Unicorn. I was trying to do a different type of allocation of memory so that I could get around some certain detections at the time or whatnot. And I couldn't figure it out. And I remember I woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning. My brain was thinking while I was sleeping. And I woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning, wrote the answer down on paper, went back to sleep, and then the next day coded it. And, you know, it's that type of drive, I think, that you know, is so exciting. And that's why I have fun in those engagements where you're into something that you haven't seen before and you have to create something unique or new because of a specific challenge.
Yeah, and I mean, I think your willingness to sort of jump in and create tools and actually also to then make them available to the community is something that it's kind of a hallmark of who you are and how you approach things. It's one of the things that's helped you build the reputation that you have within the community, and it's something we appreciate. So why don't you give us an example?
So I was on an engagement recently, and this was, I can actually tell you the exact date based on the commits. It was on April 17th, I was on an engagement. And we were going after a customer, and this is actually kind of a funny story because it was a red team engagement, and we were supposed to start the engagement on a Monday. Okay. And so we're like, you know, we're doing some OSINT, we're looking at it. I had a little bit of extra hours to burn. I was on with a couple of my other teammates, and there was sort of three people on the red team going after this one organization. And we just started finding just some like crazy stuff. Like, we already got around their authentication mechanism. We were able to authenticate, like, and this is before we're even supposed to start the test. So we notify the customer, like, hey, can we start a little bit early by any chance? And like, is that work for you? And they're like, yeah, sure, we don't care. And so we started on a Thursday. And by Friday, we had full access to everything. Like, we completely compromised the entire organization in and out, had access to all their sensitive data, their segmented network, everything by Friday. So it was a one day. This red team was supposed to last like 5 weeks, by the way. And so, oops.
I mean, writing reports does take a while. So.
It does. It definitely takes 5 weeks to write a report for that.
But that was probably an amazing report.
Yeah, well, they had a lot of pictures that they drew themselves.
But what's interesting about that one is, you know, like for assessors, you know, where we get a lot of our excitement from is obviously the hacking part, but it's also when customers are like, you know, damn, you guys are good. You know, like that.
Right.
And you know, that's, you know, like when you get that you know, assurance, like, wow, you all are better than I thought you were, things like that. Like, that's awesome for us. It's great, you know, camaraderie for the team that we're doing the right things. And so we get on with the customer, and I'll talk about how we got around him in here in just a second. But we get on the customer the next day, and it was like totally stone cold, no emotion whatsoever. You know, like, we were like, hey, we broke into everything before we were even supposed to start the engagement. And the customer's like, oh, that doesn't sound good. Okay, thanks. Appreciate it. Like, wait, we just did this righteous hack, you know, like one day, and this is all we got. So it was like, we were all like after the car, like, oh man, that could have been so much cooler. But what ended up happening was, because of COVID-19, they shifted their workforce to work from home very quickly, and they removed two-factor authentication from their VDI environment. Which is not a good idea, by the way, just throwing that out there, you know, for everybody out there. Do not do that, right?
Not recommended.
Yeah, not recommended at all. So we were able to leverage one of the Microsoft endpoints to do brute forcing against the user accounts. And we were able to define, you know, the traditional ones, you know, summer 2020, winter 2020, you know, the big and hot ones right now. I'm not going to get into politics, but whatever candidate you want, 2020 exclamation point, you know, all those become very important, you know, for brute forcing. And we got a handful of accounts. I think we got like eight with our first round of series of those. And we logged into each one, and none of them had access to the VDI infrastructure except for one. And so we were able to use this one user who was a regular user and they're in finance to log into the VDI infrastructure. And then from there, we were directly on the internal network. There was little to no network segmentation. The VDI instance basically was a full-fledged operating system that we had in the organization.
Ouch.
And yeah, oops. So the problem with that, though, is that we were running as under the context of a regular user account. They were running very specific, you know, EDR products and things like that. So we don't want to go, you know, super loud the first day, you know, especially as we're trying to become more of an adversary trying to compromise. So more living off the land, more exploratory and understanding the network infrastructure and architecture, things that wouldn't trigger. An EDR, by the way, is an endpoint detection response. And living off the land is using what's built into the operating system, you know, to not cause any type of notice of certain things happening. So like, you know, being able to leverage enumeration tools, things like that. I would stay away from things like NetUser or WhoAmI or Command.exe, those types of things. But other, you know, applications that can query the domain to extract users and groups, to understand, you know, how their network architecture is designed and systems that are connected to it, file shares, group policy settings. You know, all of those things become really important as you're starting to kind of understand the infrastructure. And we were going through when you open up Internet Explorer in a company, it almost always points to their intranet page. It's just a normal thing. And intranet pages are great treasure troves of information, because normally it's just a complete disaster and mess of data. And so we started going through and combing through all the different areas on their intranet site. And we found a web.config file that contained a SQL Server username and password that was actually the SA account. Yeah. So, hey, that's great, right?
What's an SAA account?
The systems administrator account. It's essentially like the God mode of SQL Server. It allows you to control everything.
Root for SQL.
Yep, root for SQL. Yep. Okay. And this is MS SQL. So we're talking the SA account itself allows for authentication. And then what ends up happening with that is if you can authenticate with an SA account, even if there's a stored procedure called the XP command shell stored procedure, which allows for direct operating system querying. So essentially, if you can compromise a SQL server with SA permissions, you have the ability to compromise the full server and break out of just SQL to the full command line operating system. And then from there, full remote code execution. Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Sounds no bueno.
No. And even the best part about it is that even if you're like stealthy and you're like, oh, I'm going to disable XP command shell store procedure, which on 2005 and above, it's automatically disabled, but you can reconfigure the XP command shell store procedure and then re-enable it directly through SQL. So you can still do remote code execution even if it's disabled, right? So fun stuff there. So we find this web.config file and it contains these SQL strings there. Now, the problem is that, again, we're trying to stay low and slow. We're not trying to set off alarms or to, you know, cause any issues whatsoever. And so what I started looking for was, you know, legitimate applications or tools, especially ones that are code signed or things that I could do that didn't require me to install something. Because if I have to install something, I have to be an administrator for that. And I was an administrator and I didn't want to do privilege escalation techniques because, again, I don't want to trip up any alarms. And so I'm looking around and I cannot find anything. If you look at the Microsoft tools, for example, you have to install a SQL driver. Again, administrator level permissions. Even old stuff that I used to use, like SQL exec and things like that, you know, it's funny. There was a tool that I used to use called SQL exec, you know, in you know, probably around 2006, 2007. Real shady tool out of China. You could barely see any English in it and everything. And it worked really well. But the problem was, is that I never knew that it didn't require admin rights, because back in 2006, everybody had admin rights.
Everyone's admin, right?
Yeah. So I'm like, well, hey, I'm sure this works on user land because it always worked for me. No, it didn't. So it requires admin rights. So I needed to figure out a way for me to be in this person's computer on their network without triggering any alarms to connect to a SQL server without being able to install anything at all. So I looked around, I could not find anything. I was Google hacking, I was asking friends, you know, all of our assessors, I couldn't find anything.
Which is crazy, by the way, because like, it's just another application. It's like saying that like, and there is no real reason for needing admin rights to be able to just like talk SQL. It's just a wire protocol.
Very legitimate, you know, intention right there, right? And just because they had a misconfiguration where they exposed the web.config doesn't mean that, you know, querying SQL, you know, with the username and password as a non-admin, that's not a bad practice. I mean, that's, you know, so what I ended up doing was I wrote my own tool called QuickSQL, and I released it the same day. But QuickSQL is a Python module, but I bycompiled it into an actual binary where it wraps the the Python interpreter into a single standalone executable. And, you know, at that time, it was a brand new tool. Obviously, it wasn't being flagged by anything antivirus related from an EDR perspective. You know, it looked fine. You know, it's not doing anything malicious. It's literally connecting to a database and executing commands. So I ended up uploading that executable directly to that system that we had compromised, and then used QuickSQL to authenticate to that remote SQL server with the SA username and password. And we'd fully compromised that SQL server with that username and password with full administrative level rights. And so we had full access to that server. And then from there, once we were in the server infrastructure, it was game over. We were able to move laterally across the network until we got access to everything we needed. So it was that one web that config that was the total downfall of an organization, and all within one day. And I was able to code it in one day.
Yeah. And you kind of alighted over the part of like, oh, and also I released it.
Yeah. Everything I do, I try to open source and give to the community, because I know if I'm running into that situation, you know, other folks, you know, also will be running into that situation and hopefully can use it and to help them out a bit. Even if they're not as good as, you know, good at coding or, you know, don't have the time to go and do it, anything I can do to help out people, I'm definitely all about.
Yeah. And it's all hackery. You know, like, and I think that when you release things like that, like you're setting an expectation of like, hey, I wrote this on a gig and here it is, and maybe you can make it good or something like that. Right. Rather than like, oh, I wrote this thing, and then, oh, maybe in 6 months I'll release it after I do a bunch of like boring testing and documentation work. I think that like quick iteration is kind of the heart and soul of really hackery in general and security hacking in particular.
I don't know if you know this, Dave, but Todd quite likes open source.
I like open source, and I like rapid prototyping. Those two things are two tastes that taste great together.
Absolutely.
But you also quite like open source. Like, how many open source tools have you made, or how many tools have you made and then open sourced? Might be a better way of putting it.
Probably over 100.
Good lord. that is very impressive. Maybe I shouldn't ask you this question. Do you still contribute to Metasploit? I feel like this is the kind of question where you're like, no, not so much. And I'm going to be like, oh, that's awkward.
I'm a huge fan of Metasploit, and definitely, you know, if there's issues that I see, I definitely will contribute or write modules for. You know, I wrote a lot of the post exploitation modules, the PowerShell exploitation modules, the MS SQL payload modules, and a few of the different exploits. There's some in there for IE and a few others. So definitely all about Metasploit and huge, huge fan, and have been ever since I got to first meet HD and fanboy out when I first met him.
Oh my God, but he fanboys over you just as hard. It's adorable.
Oh my God, I love that man.
It is adorable. And you co-authored Metasploit, A Pentester's Guide, which is a great book for anyone wanting to get to grips with Metasploit for pen testing. Obviously, I read it before I go to bed every night. Just a chapter.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Jenny. Every night, you know, I get a text message saying, how do I do that heap overflow again?
It's always the heap overflow.
It's always the heap overflow to get you, you know.
Boundaries are tricky, especially with like modern computers.
So the Social Engineers Toolkit set. Yep. This is something else that was a Dave Kennedy brainchild. Is that still something that you work on?
It is, yeah. So, you know, I try to keep all my tools up to date with, you know, features and functionality. Granted, you know, obviously running two businesses, I don't get to do that as much. But you know, I just did a commit about a month ago for the Social Engineer Toolkit. I have another one coming out soon. I've just been working on some side issues and bug fixes and adding additional reliability to some of the attacks that are on there. You know, with any open source project, you know, you want to make sure that it's relevant, that you stay there, and that you continuously, you know, keep it relevant as you go through. And the TrustedSec, the Social Engineer Toolkit, was always one of those things that I think really kind of skyrocketed my name out there, because it was really one of the first tools that ever came out to help you with social engineering and exploitation. And, you know, it was really the first of its kind. You know, social engineering really wasn't being applied very heavily into penetration testing at that time. And, you know, it was kind of one of those things that skyrocketed social engineering into the industry. And I'm really proud of it and definitely want to keep it going. One of my oldest tools, by the way. Yep.
Yeah. I mean, I very much remember when it came out and it was a cool thing, and it's still a cool thing. Why do you like, you know, when you go about doing this, and as much as I like to make fun of Todd, like I do actually really sort of wholeheartedly agree with his point of people can get into analysis paralysis when they're building tools and like feel like, oh, it's not good enough. And I think, you know, in the security community, and I'm sure in other communities, but I particularly live in this one, there's a lot of imposter syndrome. Like a lot of people really feel like they don't have permission, or they don't have the credibility to release something, or they haven't done enough to make it perfect. Like, how do you get past that? And why, like, you know, why do you feel like, you know, making these things open source is important? And what would you, I'm firing questions at you without giving you a chance to answer, but what would you, you know, say to somebody who is working on a tool or has an idea for a tool, but like perhaps feels a little shy about putting it out there?
You know, that's such a loaded question for me because, you know, when I came into the security industry, it was right around 2000, and I went to DEF CON, and I remember seeing, you know, Fyodor and, you know, the Shmoo group with Bruce Potter and, yeah, you know, Zimmerman and, you know, all these legends in our industry, and Mudge and all those guys, you know, all these legends in our industry that, you know, that we're standing on right now, because, you know, they were the exploratories. They were the true hacker culture that we started off with the openness and the sharing and the collaboration and you know, that's really, I when I came out of DEF CON that year at Alexis Park, that's really what I took back was community openness and sharing to make the industry better. And they were really a lot of role models for me growing up. And I don't want to say like they're super old or anything, you know, and Jeff Moss, they're just, you know, heroes to me, you know, kind of going through this industry. And granted, you know, not all heroes are perfect. And, you know, there a lot of things changed, you know, from the industry from 2000 to now that is amazing. You know, we've made a lot of progress in a lot of different areas. But, you know, community was always those things that I took back with me. And that's really the foundation of why we started DerbyCon. That's why I released all my tools. You know, that's why I try to help others because I had others helping me.
Yeah.
One of my biggest mentors, in security was Mutz from Offensive Security, Maddie. And, Maddie and I became really good friends. I was deployed in Iraq, for the military and I was part of the remote exploit team. And Maddie was really just kind of helping me along, you know, learn Python, do this, do that. And, you know, I really got into Linux and, you know, and it was one of those things where, you know, Maddie was really an inspiration to me because he told me about the open source tool piece. He's like, I'm like, hey, how do I learn Python? He's like, well, is there something that you do that annoys you, or is there something that you would like to see done that hasn't been created yet? And I'm like, well, yeah, sure. And he's like, well, go and code it. I'm like, well, what does that mean? He's like, that's exactly right. You know, and that's where the whole try harder concept came from. He's like, go and figure it out, do it, try harder to understand
right.
what you can do. And my first tool that I ever wrote was a really popular tool called Fast Track. And the stupid thing about that one was I automated DB Autopone. So that was the first feature of Fast Track. Now it eventually evolved into, you know, application scanning, automated SQL injection, remote code execution, all that other stuff. But the first iteration of it was automating DB Autopone. You know, it was just so stupid nowadays. But you know, it was just a cool, neat thing that I learned experiences from. And so, you know, for me, you know, finding good mentors, good people in the industry that are willing to help you to make you understand, that's always been my drive for me to help this community out.
Yeah, and nice to hear you giving a shout out to Mutz. You're one of your co-authors on the book, in fact.
That's right.
So I feel like we've come full circle. So yeah, hi to the offensive set guys. We do like that team. So good mentors. Lots of people don't feel like they're in that circle. Like they find it hard to, again, like if you have imposter syndrome, how do you get into the circles where you feel like you're capable of getting mentors and that kind of thing? Like I feel like there's a certain amount of like willingness to put yourself forward that you have to have, which can be hard for people, I think. Really hard if you don't know people who are willing to intro you. Like, you know, I was lucky because that guy that you mentioned earlier, HD, he made intros for me, and some other people were nice enough to introduce me around, and I got to meet people like you and others, many other people who have since done this podcast. And they've always been really kind to me and helped introduce me to people. You know, I still remember what it was like going to my first conference and how alienating it felt and how much of an imposter I felt. So, I mean, you know, is there any advice that you have for people who feel like, yeah, it's all well and good to say get good mentors, but I don't.
Like, yeah. You know, that was really our goal for DerbyCon was to create a community-friendly feel where when you came in, you know, you had people there that you could talk to that were open to talk to. Like I spent my entire time at DerbyCon just sitting, talking with people. That was my whole goal, was just to be approachable, to have, and we had, you know, attract new to InfoSec, you know, people that were brand new, you know, that were brand new in the industry, that could, you know, come in and give their own presentations of their own experiences. Because, you know, regardless if you're 1 year, 2 year, 3 years, or 1 month into InfoSec, your experiences that you have are unique to to yourself, right? And no one else has those experiences. So being able to overcome, you know, your fear of that, and being able to know that there are a lot of people out there that are willing to listen to you and your experiences and help you grow in the industry or learn off of you is just absolutely vast community than any other industry that I've ever seen before. We are very much a open community for people to come to. And don't get me wrong, there's you know, if you look at Marcus's books like Tribe of Hackers, there are different tribes in this community, right? You know, different people, sure, different experiences. But as one community, we are very accepting of one another. Don't get me wrong, there are a-holes and, you know, people that just aren't great people, you know, out there. But those are so far and few between of what the whole community has accomplished. So my recommendation, you know, for anybody out there, you know, that is, you know, concerned about, hey, if I release this, will it look bad? Ignore people that are negative to you. Focus on those that are positive to you. And there's so many positive people here in this industry that are willing to take a look at it. They're willing to help you and coach you. You just got to ask. You got to ask questions. You know, you're never going to be in trouble for asking any type of question whatsoever. Don't feel like, you know, there's not a good question out there to ask. We're here to listen. We're here to help. We're here to make this industry better, to make the world a better place. And you know, I'm always happy to help and chat with some folks. So if anybody wants to reach out to me, you know, happy to do that. I mean, we're just, you know, get over that. You just got to get over it and work with people.
That is a lovely offer, particularly from a man as busy as you are. And I think that's a lovely note to end on. So with that, I'm just going to say, Dave, thank you so much for coming on. It's so great to hear about what you're up to. I hold out hope that we will find new projects to work on together in the future.
Absolutely.
If I can find a way of shoehorning it into all the other things that you're doing.
We've got to get out of London first.
Thank you. It is great to catch up with you. And good luck, because I know you'll continue to build projects that we'll hear about and also run two companies.
Thanks so much. I appreciate you all having me on.
It's so nice to talk to Dave. What a nice chap. It's just lovely. So Todd, what is going on with you? What is happening in the world right now? I feel like some things happened this weekend.
They did. I am remarkably unhungover from the whole period of Black Hat and DEF CON, and that's probably because I didn't actually go, and nor did anyone else.
Presumably you also didn't lose your usual amount of money at the poker table. Or...
Right, yeah. So I guess, I don't know. I actually like going to Vegas, and I have a good time there, and I like seeing my hacker friends, and yeah, of course. You know, sometimes you catch a show or hang out in the pool or whatever. So anyway, I miss it a lot and it made me sad. But it did in fact happen. It happened on the internet. And I saw a couple things that were interesting.
What did you see, Todd?
I guess we'll just talk about them. Okay.
Yeah, let's do that.
So honestly, like, so there were good talks, right? Like, I kind of hated the format, but whatever. It is what it is. There was a presentation entitled Ether Oops. And it's from a couple of guys from Armis Labs, and it is bonkers crazy. So when I read the description of this thing, I thought, oh, this sounds kind of neat. It's, you know, it sounds like it might be like a, you know, packet smuggling attack, right? Like it's described as a packet in packet attack that we talk about, blah, 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 Black Hat. I'm like, okay, cool. And I figured it would be like, oh, well, maybe it's something like where if you're doing like IP packet tunneling within IP, which is a thing for some reason, or you're doing IPv4 inside IPv6 or something like that. I figured it'd be something along those lines. It was not at all anything like that. What Ether Oops is so when you have physical cable runs, and those physical cables get older and get rolled over with office chairs and whatever, they develop faults over time. And like usually like crimps or, you know, kinks in the wire or something like that. And that can cause, a tiny little short, electrical short in the cable. If this short happens to like flip a bit in a Ethernet packet, which happens somewhat commonly in older cables, the beginning of frame header can go away, right? It just doesn't it doesn't register as a beginning of frame anymore. It's supposed to be a D. It's the value is D5, and if it's anything other than that, there's a few other it can be. But if it's not D5, then it's like, oh, this is not an Ethernet packet. So like it hits the wire, it goes over the wire, it gets corrupted, it hits your network interface controller. The network interface controller is like, oh, cool, an Ethernet packet. Sends it to the CPU. CPU says like, I don't see any Ethernet packet here. Drop. And that's normally how things work in nature when you're using kind of crummy old cables.
In nature. I like that. I like that. So like these are cables in the wild. Got it.
But what these guys figured out is like, well, what if we stuffed a whole nother Ethernet packet inside that Ethernet packet? What would that look like? And so what they did was basically you wait around for this fault in the cable to manifest on the on that outer Ethernet header. And then the CPU is like, I don't see anything. Oh, wait, here's my Ethernet header right here. Let's go. And then it'll read the whole Ethernet frame. Now, that's crazy because it would require like millions and millions of packets to send at your target, hoping that they have bad cables. Incidentally, you also have to already know like the MAC addresses and like kind of the inside layout of the network. And then all this other stuff you'd have to know ahead of time. No problem, says the folks from Armis. They're like, well, you don't actually have to wait for these faults. You can make your own faults with an EMP generator. You can make an electromagnetic pulse. And then they go into this whole thing about like, here's how we made our EMP generator. It's just a little spark gap thing. And you set it up like kind of near a longish cable. and then just pop, 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 fire it off while you're sending these evil packets in. So what you get basically is you get to smuggle an entire Ethernet frame in, which means you get, you know, it's everything. It's MAC address, it's protocol, it's port, it's everything. It's like from end to end. So you can smuggle these over like a NAT device. You know, normally you're not, you shouldn't be able to talk over NATs. Like that's what network address translation does. You can smuggle them over firewalls. You can smuggle them past IDSs, you know, everything. So it's like basically like all the kind of internally networky things that's not supposed to be exposed on the internet. You can pop through if these weirdo conditions are met. Now, this will never happen in the real world. This is not a practical attack by any means, because either you have to be close by with your EMP device, or you'll end up like frying everyone's circuits. If you make it too, like if you want range on your EMP, that means you have to have more power, and more power means you start frying electronics nearby. And so your EMP device has to be pretty low power, which means it has to be close. Or you like are in a position to replace a cable with like a messed up cable, but not too messed up that it keeps just pumping packets all the time. So you have your carefully constructed, like sometimes faulty cable. But if you can do that, why not just
this is what you would describe a very targeted attack.
It is. It's insanely targeted. But I don't think that's what the research is actually good for. I like the research a lot, and it's a crazy security implication. What ended up happening for me anyway was like, I consider myself a little bit of a network nerd. I know like how protocols work and stuff. I felt Galaxy Brain happening in my head when I was listening to this talk. Like when I came in, I'm like, what are they even talking about? This would never work in the real world. By the middle, I'm like, what's going on here? What's happening? What have I been doing with my life this whole time? And then by the end, I'm like, aha, I get it. I understand like how, like the differences between signal on the wire versus signal on the network interface versus signal on the CPU. Like, and that's like, I think a major level up. And like in the time that I've been doing networking, like I've never really stopped and considered that. So what this fundamentally is, it's like one of these attacks that I love where it's a, let's read the RFC, let's read the spec and see what the spec says you're supposed to do in these failure conditions and then do that. And you end up like learning a ton about like how physical networking works, you know, how electronic signaling works, and like also incidentally like how EMPs work. Oh, and I didn't mention like the coup de grace of the whole thing.
Yeah, that's how that's said, exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Yep. Tell me more about
Gracie.
Yeah.
The coup de grace is after all of this business, okay, cool, you get your one packet. You can send your one packet. What do you send? Like, okay, you can make a wish, but it's in a very tiny parameterized set.
It's a teeny tiny fairy drop in.
Mm-hmm. The wish they make is, I'm going to send this thing called an IPv6 router advertisement packet. What's that, you might ask? Well,
what's that for?
A router advertisement packet, so like in normal networking where we all do DHCP, DHCP says like, oh, I just woke up and I need an IP address. So, hey, anyone, can you give me an IP address? And somebody says, here you go.
what router advertisement packets are they are unignorable, saying like, hey dog, here's your new router on IPv6. Oh, and by the way, I know I'm IPv6, but I'm going to give you an IPv4 address for your router and your DNS server and your lookup domain and all this other like network configuration garbage that you can't ignore. Like if you're IPv6, you can't ignore this stuff. This is bonkers crazy. Like this is not how normal networking works, where like an anonymous source can just say like, yep, here's all your new stuff. Have a bless. So yeah, these router advertisement packets are crazy. And like that in itself is a finding for me, because I don't know that much about like that initial router discovery stuff that goes on in IPv6. I think that alone is like a finding that you could like walk into a pen test with. Like, let's say you're doing like an internal network assessment or something. You're able to like just drop in on these networks, send out these router advertisement packets, and people will believe you. And it'll be like, oh, this must be my new DNS address. So like once you do this, like this basically gives you control over all of their DNS. You can do things like set up like web proxies and all this other junk over that. So that was crazy. But anyway, there was so much packed in this talk. So anyway, I want you to go look it up right now as soon as this podcast is over.
I'm assuming that you're talking to the listeners and not me.
I am. Yes. Well, also you. It's fun. Uh-huh. Ether Oops.
I'm so excited. It's adorable. I love it.
It's pretty cool. Anyway, it was the coolest thing I've seen in a while. And yeah, and like ultimately it's not that big of a deal from like an attack point of view, except for this router advertisement over IPv6 thing. The actual attack is just like kind of funny. but it does end up like accidentally teaching you a ton about electrical engineering. So,
but this is
pretty cool.
This is like, okay, so the conferences have gone through a hard time this year for sure. And there's like, you know, there's a lot of chatter about like how unsatisfactory the virtual experience is and all that kind of stuff. But this, like the enthusiasm that you have right now, the fact that you learn a whole bunch of new stuff over something that is an area that you actually feel like you're already pretty knowledgeable about. And it's not like you signed up for training. Like this is from a talk. That right there, that's what these events are all about. And I think it's super cool that you got that value out of it. That is really awesome.
It is pretty. Now, like if this was the only thing, and is that worth $2,000, whatever the ticket price is to back at? Probably not.
I mean that is a hell of a price tag for a virtual conference.
there's a little bit of a trade off there, but yeah, like this is the kind of thing that I'm actually really interested in, The multi-track thing kills me. The fact that it's virtual kills me, because I ended up working like almost the whole weekend anyway, yeah. while doing this stuff. So, anyway, Etheroops, go check it out. Looking forward to my next real conference.
I know. Right. Yes. Be nice to be able to see people again. Were there any other things that you saw at the events that sort of grabbed your attention?
There was. I was involved in the voting village, so I saw that as I did it.
That is convenient.
I ended up kind of binging on like a lot of the election content.
Why is that? Is there a thing happening soon? I don't.
There is. Like when this airs, it'll be something like 85-ish days until the next major election in the U.S.
I saw a headline today about how Russia is helping Trump again. I was like, this is great. Like, where's my popcorn?
You know, back in my day, when the U.S. were interfering with elections, we did it secretly.
That's what galls you, isn't it? Is you're just like, have they no class?
I know. This is a very, like, gentlemen don't read each other's mail kind of thing.
No, gentlemen don't talk about reading each other's mail, I think is the point. Like, be a little circumspect about this.
I don't know if any of the material. So I know that our panel from the Voting Village is posted on YouTube somewhere. If you just look up, I think probably my name and like Casey Ellis's name and voting, like you'll find it.
Hello, Casey.
Yes, your cousin Casey, yeah. Your Australian cousin.
Yep.
I saw Krebs's thing. Brian Krebs, not Krebs, not Brian Krebs. Chris Krebs.
Right. Yep. The other Krebs.
Chris Krebs. Yeah, the other Krebs. He's a director.
He's the director of Deja Scissor. Yeah.
He had a thing on election security, which was interesting for sure. Like this is a guy who's like, who is in those classified briefings and then also has to do a bunch of unclassified stuff, which is, I don't know how you do that job, but good for him.
Is he the one who, because I saw this as a headline and it had a picture of him with the headline, and it said, U.S. officials now warning that logistics is a bigger threat than security for elections.
Yeah.
Did he come out with that? I was like, I mean, I was kind of like, doy. I mean, like, obviously.
He did. So he talked. Yeah, he ended up talking a lot about how, like, analog backups is the thing. And I'm like, okay. So, like, which is great, right? Like, you should have analog backups for everything. But he was like, I don't know, it seemed a little Pollyanna, where it's like, oh, well, look, if all of our computers go away, we could just all pull out all our analog backups, and we better make sure we have those. And I'm like, where do you think all this is coming from? Because, like, so I've worked in an election in Texas recently, and we have this thing called an e-poll book. And the poll book is the thing that you look up to see that the person who's standing in front of you is actually eligible to vote, right? It's all online. It's all over the network. It's a two-way communication thing and everything, right? It's a normal network app, right? If that e-poll book system goes offline, I have nothing. I asked around, like, so let's say, like, there's some failure here, and, like, I can't look things up on my poll book. They're like, well, we'll try to fix it for probably about a half an hour, and then we will close the polling station. And I'm like, cool. So great. I don't know if that's going to be the plan in November here in Travis County, Texas. I hope not, because that would be a great way to basically kick your selected precincts offline. And also the logistics, as you mentioned, and as Chris Krebs mentioned, is difficult, because, like, let's say that you want to defend against this with, like, a physical poll book. Well, in my county, anyone can vote in any precinct. It's not a very short list. So basically, I would have a book of about 1 million and change voters that I would have to look up manually. This sucks. Like, that's a terrible solution.
That's quite the little black book there.
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty fat. Now, I've done elections, like, years and years ago where we didn't have that, where you had to vote in your precinct and your precinct only. And a lot of places are like that. Like, you have exactly one polling place where you can go to. That book is manageable. That book is, like, a few thousand. But yeah, when you're looking at, like, 1 million people that you have to validate, and everyone, you have to validate them all, or else, like, you know, oh no, voter fraud, which never happens anyway, but whatever. but you have to do it.
I thought there was data saying that voter fraud was a thing. Is that not a thing? Is that misinformation?
Voter fraud is not a thing. There's election fraud's a thing. But voters going out and voting twice, or voting when they're not allowed, it happens.
But, like, to people voting under names that are not real?
It never happened.
Dead people voting?
That's kind of a 19th century problem.
Okay. Do you see dead voters? That's what I really want to know.
Is that what we're going to... No, I don't. Generally not. Yeah. So anyway, so Krebs's note about, like, oh yeah, analog backups. That sounds great. It is a lot of paper. It's a lot of ink, and it's a lot of, like, eyeball time, like squishy human eyeball time, not, you know, silicon computer eyeballs.
Okay.
I'm a big fan of computers and doing things that they do well, which is, like,
that's what I was gonna say. Is this as much because he painted a picture of a world where the computers have gone away, and you just couldn't get your brain past that. You were like, what are you saying? Why would you say this?
And it's an outcome. Now, personally, I don't expect, like, and Krebs had gone into this too. It's like, he had said that the kind of hacking activity, you know, the scanning and hacking traffic that they're able to see, which of course is not going to be the totality of it, but compared to where they were in 2016, he said pretty much straight out, it's like, oh yeah, hacking is down and disinfo is up. So, like, the tactic isn't so much like, let's go in and change votes or change voter rolls or knock polling places online. The tactic is, let's get very targeted Facebook ads.
Yeah.
And that's it, right? So, and that's probably enough that it'll work. You know, the kinds of attacks that we saw in 2016, the best attack ever was the Podesta attack, where he got personally spearfished, a campaign manager for Hillary Clinton's campaign. And so, like, you're not going to see that ahead of time. You're not going to see, like, a pattern leading up to that. It just happens that day. So I don't expect polling place. I don't expect votes to be changed, right, by malicious actor, like, after they've been cast. But I do expect to see them changed before they were cast. And that's the whole point of disinformation.
Yep. I hear you. Okay, fair enough. All right, well, Todd, thank you. Thank you for taking us through all of this stuff. I appreciate it. It sounds like you had a very interesting weekend of viewing.
Yep, it was all right. next year, Vegas. Come on. Yeah. I miss it.
Yeah. I know you do. All right, well, thank you very much. And I look forward to our next thrilling episode. Hooray!